It is December 18th. Welcome into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
My name is Avi Wolfman. Aaron, so glad to have you with us today. And I'm really excited about today's episode.
Okay.
A little backstory. Mm-hmm. I was reading the Washington Post, and they had this story recently about the best cookbooks of 2024. And I'm reading through it, and here's a quote from one of the reviews mm-hmm. of these great cookbooks. It is one of the most generous cookbooks I have ever read. It's revolutionary.
Wow.
It's a relief. And I said, what cookbook is this? It's called You Gotta Eat. And lo and behold, local author behind it, Margaret Eby, who is an editor with the Philadelphia Inquirer. So I said, this sounds like something we should talk about in the show. And I told that to our producer, Debbie Builder. And immediately she looked at the book because it's about sort of cooking when you feel burnt out and you don't mm-hmm. want to cook anymore. And she was like, not only is this an interview, it's a whole episode, because Debbie was like, I feel this way like yeah. every day.
Me too, by the way.
Me three. I think Debbie said her unofficial name in her house is What's for Dinner. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And a lot of people feel that way. Like, cooking can be a joy, but can also be a burden. And so today we're going to talk about cooking when you don't feel like cooking. Hacks, simplifying things, rethinking the food that's already in your house, mm-hmm. right? So you can make it just a little bit more special.
You know, I used to always, my mom is one of these people where she just goes in there and finds stuff and yeah. puts together a meal and it's
like
decent.
Like a wizard.
And I'm just like, how do you do that? Like, with some beans and some what? Like
some beans and some what? Two ingredients, beans and what?
And you make it into a meal.
That's
and
what
it's
this
good.
Book really is.
And that's what this book is about. And
it really
I'm excited
is.
About it. Yeah.
Like, there could be a chapter in here called Beans and What? And it would work. Like,
it really
it's
would.
Kind of what the book is. Mm-hmm. So I really love the book. So we're going to have Margaret on, but we're also going to talk with Mark Bittman, mm-hmm. who's been known for years and years and years for minimalist cooking. Long time at the New York Times and wrote very, very famous cookbooks, several of them. So really excited to talk with him. And our question for you this hour, listen up, because I feel like this is going to be a good audience participation hour.
I think so, too.
The question is, when you don't feel like cooking, what's your easy go-to meal? And don't say drive through at Wendy's.
No, what's in your pantry? What
exactly.
do you put together? Yeah.
Give us a call. 888-477-9499 or studio2@whyy.org. No judgment on drive through at Wendy's. That's just not what the prompt is today, right?
No. And the thing is, this is a judgment-free zone.
So
if it's weird, we want to hear it even more.
I'm looking at some weird ones right now, and I cannot wait to read them.
Yes, because we might find a new delicious meal. We don't know, or a snack or something.
Expand your mind this hour, folks. You're going to have to expand your mind.
Exactly. I'm looking forward to hearing from you. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And now, Avi, our trio of news stories.
Start us off.
For today. Well, President-elect Donald Trump, you may have heard about this. He is again proposing to privatize the United States Postal Service. This was an idea he previously pursued, but it was a very unsuccessful.
Yeah.
And so this idea gets circulated every so often because the Postal Service has been operating at a deficit for quite a while. So Trump's past proposal to overhaul the Postal Service, it faced bipartisan opposition, and people are expecting that this new proposal would encounter similar resistance. So privatization, of course, could lead to significant job losses for Postal Service employees. I mean, we have thousands in our yeah. region. I have family members who work for the Postal Service. Have been for years. And so there's a lot of pushback. But for folks who didn't know, the U.S. Postal Service has
local
a very
tie.
Philly connection.
Local tie. Here it comes.
It was founded in Philadelphia in 1775. Benjamin Franklin was the first postmaster general, and he was celebrated for increasing the efficiency of the agency's bookkeeping and its delivery routes. So he was a very good postmaster general. By the way, a lot of people love the Postal Service, even though it is not the best, because it goes everywhere throughout the country and it delivers 6 days a week and it's built into the U.S. Constitution. Mm. So I think if you want to get rid of it, I do think it needs to be overhauled. But at the same time, getting rid of it won't be easy.
or popular, I would imagine. Mm-hmm. Man, Benjamin Franklin, though.
Ben Franklin.
Just everything. Imagine his LinkedIn page.
Yeah.
The amount of number of jobs he would have on there. Yeah. Previous experience in. It's amazing. He was the first Postmaster General. I think mm-hmm. I kind of knew that, but I'd forgotten. Yeah. But shout out to the Inquirer for pointing out that this is a Philadelphia institution.
And if you drive down in Old City, you can see some of the remnants of all of that mm-hmm. right in Old City off of Market Street. And I mean, it's just, I don't know. Everything ties back to Philadelphia.
Sure does, including our second story. There's a new film out. This also, somehow I missed this. It's coming. It's not sort of out yet, but it's mm-hmm. already been at the big festivals, and it's getting a ton of buzz. It's called The Brutalist, and it's a fictional story, but it's set in Philadelphia, and it tells the story of a Jewish Hungarian architect who flees Europe, survives the Holocaust, and immigrates to the U.S., to Philadelphia, lands in Philadelphia. And when he gets here, this architect, he meets up with a cousin who runs a furniture store in Philly, and he gets a job through him shoveling coal. Mm. And so it's an immigrant story. And the turn happens when he's sort of rediscovered by this very fancy upper crust Philadelphian, kind of based off of the real life Albert Barnes. Mm. And this fancy Philadelphian realizes that this great architect is laboring away in Philadelphia and says, "Let me be your patron, basically. And I want you to build this great building for me." Again, it's called The Brutalist, stars Adrian Brody, Guy Pearce, Felicity Jones, Joe Alwyn, big stars, getting tons of amazing reviews. It doesn't actually sort of, you can't see it in theaters probably until January here in Philadelphia, but let's play a clip. This is Adrian Brody being handed his character, being handed some of his architectural designs. Let's take a listen.
"These are yours, yes?
Yes.
All of them?
Yes.
Tell me, why is an accomplished foreign architect shoveling coal here in Philadelphia?"
"I'm afraid it is not so simple."
Moody, I have to say, moody. It was beautifully shot, and I watched multiple, you know, little previews of the film or sizzle reels, and it was beautifully shot. You can tell it's going to be up for all sorts of awards,
yeah,
just
is,
the way
yeah.
that
Seven Golden
it is
Globes.
Shot. Yeah, it looks like one of those big Best Picture type of films. But by the way, I just have to mention this. It's more than 3.5 hours long. And there is
That's the
a
sound
15,
of you not watching it.
And there is a 15-minute intermission. Okay? Like, I just want to point that out for the people because...
But it does look interesting.
It looks good, though.
And it's interesting that they actually did not shoot the film in Philadelphia.
That is
even though
true.
It's set in Philadelphia, they shot it in Hungary because it's about architecture. And a lot of our brutalist architecture is
no longer here.
It's either no longer here or there's too much other stuff in the way that would give away sort of the period mm-hmm. that we're in, right? And so they ended up shooting it in Hungary. But Philadelphia was a center of great architectural design and innovation, which is why the story is set here. So it ties into something real that did happen in
Philadelphia.
And
you have big name stars here. It's beautifully shot. It's an immigrant story.
And it's also about the relationship between sort of patrons
exactly.
and artists, which I think is pretty interesting. It looks moody. It looks deep. It looks dark.
And
it looks like we're
big.
Probably not going to see it because we don't have long attention spans.
And I would have to eat a whole meal in order to attend it. But at the same time, I feel like
Wait,
it's
is that a transition?
Win. That was.
Okay, go ahead.
A little bit of a
third
transition.
Story.
Since so good. I tried to throw it in there. You caught the ball. Go ahead, Avi. So our third story for today is about a unique food hall and delivery service that is coming to Philadelphia. And you probably wonder, Cherry, what is this? Well, think Amazon warehouse, but for food.
I don't want to think about that.
Yes. And the way it works, chefs will make items from dozens of restaurants, including brands owned by celeb chefs like Bobby Flay and Jose Andreas, but they'll do it all in one place. They'll use these Turbo Chef ovens, which are about $20,000 for one little oven, and automated fryers. And they say that everything is made to order and delivered in under 30 minutes. So there you go.
And it's called Wonder.
Wonder, yes.
Wonder. It exists in other places. It's now coming to Philadelphia. This could be the future of the restaurant industry. It's kind of cool.
But it's takeout.
It's kind of dystopian. The idea that all our food would just be cooked in one big cooking warehouse and then just sent to us probably by drone. In
oh my
under
goodness,
30
you
minutes.
Threw drones in there.
Similar concepts do exist, but the reason why Wonder is so buzzy is because there's a ton of venture capital behind it.
Yeah.
So anyways, this new concept, it's coming to Philly, a big warehouse of takeout food. That's the future.
And I should say people are there are some critics because they say that, you know, it's going to take up a lot of retail space where small restaurants might otherwise go. And it's going to cut into the restaurant business. Philly's a food town. People love going to these little mom and pop restaurants.
So will it still be a food town when you can just press a button and your Bobby Flay dish will come to you in 25 minutes?
It's crazy.
It is crazy.
The world is changing right in front of our eyes, Avi.
And that's why we need to go back to simplicity, especially when it comes to cooking, Jerry. So we're going to talk about simplifying cooking coming up. That's the theme. And we want to know, what's your go-to meal when you don't feel like cooking? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Avi, at the end of a long, stressful workday, it's hard to muster the energy to cook dinner. I mean, you have to pull up a recipe. You have to get out the pots and pans. You have to start chopping. And then you have to stand over a hot stove. But we all have to eat. And if you don't want to order takeout again, you have to make something.
Yes, you have to make something.
You do.
And sometimes cooking can feel like a real chore. So today we're talking with two people who found ways to streamline the process, make things simpler, even when you aren't feeling your best. With us in studio is Margaret Eby, deputy food editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She has a new cookbook aimed at precisely those days when even opening a can feels like a heavy lift. It's called You Gotta Eat. Margaret, welcome to Studio 2.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
We are thrilled to have you. And we also invited, we had to invite, the master of minimalist cooking, Mark Bittman, former New York Times food columnist, author of one of the great cooking Bibles, How to Cook Everything. And he has a new one out called How to Cook Everything Kids. Mark Bittman, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Avi and Cherry. Great to meet you all.
Great to meet you, too. And our question for you, our listeners, is what is your go-to meal when you really don't feel like cooking? Share your meal hacks and shortcuts. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And Avi, how about we bring in a caller since we already have the lines lit up?
This idea has clearly lit a spark.
I know.
Because the phone lines are already busting over.
So let's bring in Shweta from Paoli, who wants to share her go-to meal. Shweta, you're on Studio 2. What's your go-to meal?
So my favorite meal, and this is our family's favorite meal too, it's called a Bombay sandwich, which is what we used to get as street food when I grew up in India. It's literally bread. You know, you can take wheat bread, white bread. Now I eat wheat bread. But it's like you put tomatoes, slices of tomatoes, slices of boiled potato, thin slices, cucumber, you can put beetroot, and then you can put a slice of cheese. If you have some sauces, like spread, you can put it on both sides. I use green chutney. That's the Indian green mint and coriander chutney on both sides. And then you just put some butter on the outside and lightly grill it. Oh, I'm sorry. And you also add spices. We use, salt, pepper. You can put some spices, chili powder, cumin, we use chaat masala, which is our general spice, and it's delicious. So
it sounds amazing.
I know.
So it's called a Bombay sandwich. Did I get that right?
Yes, and I'm actually hungry now.
That's Shweta from Paoli.
It is lunchtime. Thanks, Shweta. Margaret, you're listening to that, and I feel like it's almost like writing your cookbook for you right there. What did you make of the Bombay sandwich?
Okay, that sounds so good. That sounds so delicious. I feel like sandwiches are incredible vehicles for anything you want because, I mean, my mom used to just slice a banana and put it between two slices of bread and eat it. No condiments, no nothing, just banana sandwich, which, you know, to each their own. But I feel like, you know, as my book says, anything is a sandwich if you're not a coward. So you can really just throw anything in there. It's beautiful.
And Margaret, by the way, I have cookbooks, not saying I read them all, but I have them in my kitchen. And your book is unlike any that I've seen in that it's like the cookbook for people who don't want to cook. But can you tell me your philosophy and intention for putting this book together?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is basically there's not a wrong way to feed yourself. I think when you get into the kitchen, there can be all this pressure. There can be all these thoughts about like, well, like I have to make this beautifully composed dish or I have to include all these things. And I understand it completely. I've worked at these big glossy food magazines. But the truth is that even the fanciest food people on earth come home from their long shifts in the kitchen and they're like, you know what would be great? Cheetos on peanut butter.
What?
I'm telling you.
Is that real?
It's delicious.
That's real. That's real. It is weirdly delicious. Like the most unhinged sandwich ideas are from chefs I know because they're like, yeah, man, you never know what you can do with crumbled up like Chex Mix. And I'm like, you know, I praise it. I understand. I think, you know, there's an idea that you have to have this vision of perfection, this sort of like Instagram beautiful meal. And no, like a kitchen is a place where you get to have fun. Like you get to like just throw things together. You put it on a plate. You don't have to tell anyone about it. You should tell me because I want to know. But like
your DMs are open.
I really want to know. People have been sending me pictures of weird nachos and it is my love language.
That's the next book, by the way.
Truly.
Weird nachos.
Weird nachos.
Yes. One person put gravy on them and I was like, you are cooking with gas. I love this.
Gravy.
Yes.
Gravy on nachos.
So yeah. So let's just stop for a second because I think what this book does, because there's lots of weird, I don't want to say weird, unusual recipes that we could get into in the book. But I think what it does is it makes you take a step back and think like, not how has this ingredient been used in the past, but what is it? And so Mark Bittman, I want to get your perspective on that. Like, how do you get people to deprogram their brains a little bit to think about an ingredient or a food as, you know, an acid as opposed to, you know, salsa, right? Because you can, it's almost a little bit like reworking the interior of your brain. And I'm curious how you get people to do that.
I mean, I think increasingly people are taking Margaret's attitude and saying, look, let's just eat something. And I think that that's right. The key is to have food in the house. I mean, you can't make it happen if you don't have a pantry, if you don't have stuff in the refrigerator. I mean, if you're willing to eat ramen and tuna fish and random stuff on sandwiches all the time, then you're fine. But if you want a variety of stuff and you want to be eating, let's say, real food, honest to goodness food, it can be done really simply. And again, as Margaret says, anything is a sandwich if you're brave enough. You just have to have that stuff in the house. So there's a way in which shopping is primary. And I, you know, you guys were talking about Wonder before, which by the way is terrible, but
you'll find
that out soon enough. Your instincts are correct. It's not going to be any good, but you know, it's easy enough to get food into the house now because we have, you know, just as you can order takeout, you can order ingredients. And it's just so much easier to put stuff together, a chopped salad, a little soup, some rice and beans, blah, blah, blah. If the stuff is in the house in the first place, if you're looking to make something and there's nothing there, then it becomes a real challenge.
Yeah, I want to bring in another caller because we have quite a few on the line right now. We have Elizabeth from Bryn Mawr. Elizabeth, you're on Studio 2. What's your go-to meal?
So I work full time, and every weekend I would be remiss if we did not buy either a pack of boneless, skinless chicken breasts or bone-in, skin-on chicken. And what I do is I walk in from work, and I throw a really hot skillet into the oven, add a little olive oil, let's say the bone-in, skin-on chicken, salt and pepper, and I leave it in there for a good 45 minutes until I have a chance to get undressed and do what I have to do to, like, decompress from walking in. And it's so reminiscent of my Jewish heritage growing up. The house smells great when everyone gets home. It's the easiest, most delicious, like, finger-licking dinner. And it is, like, become mom's chicken at this point because everyone knows that flavor. And to Mark Bittman's point, like, to pick up boneless, skinless, or a bone-in, skin-on at the supermarket over the weekend is, you know, easy enough. It comes in those shrink-wrapped, you know, organic packages now, so it stays easily for 3 or 4 days. So if I don't make it on Monday, I can make it on Thursday. Yeah. And I'm telling you, the house smells delicious. Yeah. Easiest dinner ever. Thank you. That's Elizabeth
from Bryn Mawr. And, you know, it's interesting because I'm the designated cook in my house, and I do love the boneless, skinless chicken thighs. They're so good. But I want you to each give us, like, a grocery list, because it starts from being able to go to your pantry and open your fridge and make something. Requires, like Mark said, you kind of have to have this stuff around. So if you were just normal shopping over time, like, what kind of things would you collect so you could be in a position to just stand at the pantry and have something to eat? And we'll start with you, Margaret.
Yeah, I would say I love to invest in things like frozen vegetables, canned beans, things that are not going to turn into piles of green mush in my fridge if I ignore them for 4 days. I would also say condiments, huge, spices, and using spices, like our first caller said, like, spices add so much robustness to anything you've got going on. If you have leftovers, if you're like, you know, all I can really muster is, like, throwing a few things together. Or, I mean, that chicken sounded so good. You just, like, throw whatever spice combination you want. Also, to your point, Abby, I think one of the things it's a cool trick. I think Mark literally taught me this from his books, which is very much how I learned to cook, is that if you start thinking about condiments as their individual components, which can take a little time, it actually makes things so much easier. Mm. So
give me an example of that.
So say you have a jar of salsa.
Yep.
What's a jar of salsa? It's chopped up vegetables, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's chopped up tomatoes. It's chopped up chilies. There's no reason that you can't throw that in with some beans. There's no reason that you can't put that in with some chicken, right? Like, it's just chopped up vegetables.
Can I give you an example of that from my cooking past? Is that my wife, I noticed when I met her, she would eat mac and cheese with salsa. And when I first saw it, it kind of blew my mind. I said, those things don't go together. But then what I realized over time, and it was really solidified by reading your book, is that the only reason I don't think of those two things together is because they don't come from the same food tradition. Mm-hmm. But a fatty, starchy, pasta-y thing with a nice, bright, you know, acidic salsa makes perfect sense food-wise. And so I think that is part of what I'm talking about, deprogramming yourself from seeing the ingredient as it was always used. And for me, mac and cheese and salsa really clarified that.
Completely.
What do you think, Mark? You're laughing.
Are you laughing at everything? I put salsa.
You're laughing. You're laughing at me or with me?
No, thanks. Well, with you, absolutely with you.
Yeah.
Would you eat salsa and mac and cheese, Mark Bittman?
I mean, I there's times we all put anything on anything, and I think we're happy about that. Cheetos on peanut butter can sound appealing at times. I think, you know, Margaret's shopping list is right. When you think about the last 100 years, there's a lot of ways in which we're stuck in the past. But in the last 100-150 years, both refrigerators and freezers were invented. And, we use refrigerators and they do a great job. But freezers are underused. And there's just jillions of things that you can buy frozen that are actually really good or buy fresh and throw in the freezer. And sure, takes a little thinking ahead, but nutritionally, you're not losing much by freezing stuff, and you can have the convenience of having even more things in your house. I mean, the only thing I'd add, and maybe dispute with Margaret's list, is that I do like to have vegetables in the refrigerator all the time. And it's true that sometimes they turn into green slime and you feel bad about that, but you also feel great if you decide to make a chopped salad and you have, you know, cauliflower and red peppers and lettuce and a few other things. And, you know, the canned beans go in there and maybe you cook some rice, and, you know, rice also freezes well. And now you can buy rice frozen. I mean, the resources are there. It's a, you know, I go back to what I said in the first place. You have to have stuff in the house. You can't cook if you don't have stuff in the house in the first place.
Yeah, you gotta kind of have things in the fridge, in the freezer already. Yeah.
And you mentioned green slime. Green slime comes up in the book, Margaret, because you talk about how to, and this is repurposing
some
exactly
of those
and saving things before they go extinct. Give us a sense of how you save the vegetables before they become green slime, because this happens to me all of the time.
Oh my gosh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, to Mark's point, I do also believe in fresh vegetables. I tend to, especially, you know, if it's summer and you're like, oh, look at this beautiful fresh green thing. It's hard to resist, and you shouldn't if you, especially since like salad is another thing you can just like throw a bunch of things in and be a meal. But I would say green slime is a constant threat in my life. and one of the things I like to do is make kind of a trash bag green sauce with all the things that are threatening to go bad.
Trash bag green sauce.
Yeah. It's not quite a pesto. It's not a chimichurri. It's like it's got elements of all these things. But you can kind of throw in like, you know, the herbs that are like, you know, you we'll look see. At them and you're like, you got 12 hours.
Yeah.
they're like holding you ransom.
When you say throw them all together, like with what? How?
Usually my formula is like, okay, look at what you've got. Herbs. Usually for me, it's like herbs because I love herbs and I'm very ambitious about herbs. But then I'm like, oh no, I've used three herbs. And they're again in a hostage situation with me. And I do a formula of an acid. So if I have lemon or lime juice, vinegar, I love vinegar because it's always around and you don't have to, again, worry about lemons going slowly moldy, and some sort of fat. So kind of the same way you would make a pesto, thinking about it. Like you can also add a crunchy thing if you want. But so you would add like herbs and like lemon or lime juice and olive oil or sour cream or yogurt. I've done yogurt, like just some sort of, and just taste it and like add things, salt and pepper. You can throw in an anchovy if you're feeling spicy.
I love anchovies.
I love it.
Yeah.
Don't sleep on anchovies.
Yeah.
And by the way, our question for you, our listeners, what is your go-to meal when you really don't feel like cooking? You can share your meal hacks and shortcuts. Call 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. I want to bring in a couple more callers because the lines are just lit up. I want to bring in, let me see, Dawn from Bucks County, who's on the line. Dawn, you're on Studio 2. What's your go-to meal?
Hey, my go-to meal is either a baked potato or, you know, like the yam or the you know, sweet potato. Mm-hmm. So I hate shopping. I hate going to the grocery store. So when I do buy things, I make sure that they have a really good shelf life. Potatoes have a great shelf life. I also get like broccoli because you can always bring that back to life. I stick it in some water and put in some foil on it. That gets it nice and firm. But I like hot meals too. So I cook the potato, put broccoli on it, put maybe some canned beans like black beans or garbanzo beans. I put a little bit of salsa in there if I feel like it, and a little bit of cheese. But really, you can do whatever you want, and it just hits all the notes. And also, if you have someone who enjoys meat, which I don't, but my kids do, I just throw some chicken on top or, you know, throw a little bacon in there, and everybody is happy, and their bellies are full, and everybody's nourished.
So, I love this.
A potato is a canvas. A potato potato is a canvas. Yeah.
That's mm-hmm. Dawn from Bucks Absolutely. County. Thank you so much, Dawn. By the way, this is a question I want to throw out here because, Margaret, when I was looking at your book, some stuff is a snack.
Yep.
But then you can make it into a meal. And so my question for both of you is, like, how do you take something like a potato that you might not be satisfied just eating the potato?
Right.
But you take it from that and you make it into a full meal. What are the elements and the, you know, the ingredients of taking things to that level?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that baked potato sounded so good. I like to add something that has protein on it. So beans, can of beans, you have it around, so easy. Or if you have some, like, leftover chicken knocking around in the fridge. Or if you have, like, basically, I, like, assess my refrigerator as if I am, like, a baby bear and I am, like, scrounging, right? And I'm like, what scraps can I put on this baked potato? Because I also love baked potato night. Mm-hmm. Also, baked potatoes are significantly a way to eat an enormous amount of sour cream for your meal, which I'm really into. Cream. You know what I mean?
I do too.
I like to have some sort of, like, because potatoes can take a lot of dairy and a lot of, like, seasoning. So if you've got, you know, your classics, butter, cheese, sour cream, love that. But if you're like, I have not that, then you're like, yogurt? Yeah, yogurt with salt and pepper. Really good on baked potatoes. I think, like, also it's another situation where there are no rules, so if it sounds like it might be good, try it and it could be excellent. I had leftover tikka masala on a baked potato once. It was incredible.
That sounds amazing.
So good.
Can I ask you a question, Mark, about pushback you got? Like for instance, you have a lot of recipes that people can still look up on the New York Times cooking search portal. And they always stand out, right? Because of your approach to food. First of all, do you ever read the comments below the recipes?
Dangerous.
And what types of pushback did you get? And what do you make of that pushback when you started to sort of, when your type style of cooking, you know, started to be exposed to a broader audience?
I mean, no, I don't read comments. And not because I don't take them seriously, but because it's just there's lots and there's a lot of it's too much time. And often, I will say this, often, look, people don't really follow recipes. Most people look at recipes and they're like, oh, yeah, I get it. And then they go and do what they want. So if someone has a criticism of a recipe, 90% of the time, it's because they made some change or other. And then they didn't like what happened. So, you know, that's not really my issue. I get it. That's how I cook also. But I can't deal with that. This, you know, to the second question, generally, you know, when I started writing this kind of stuff in the 80s and 90s, people were obsessed with chefs and with chef cooking. It was the beginning of food TV. It was this, what I think was not very helpful trend of saying, Margaret said this before, of saying your food needs to be beautiful, you need to be able to cook like Bobby Flay, da 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 da. And really, that's not a sane ambition for most people at home. It's not a sane ambition for any non-chef, because you're not going to cook like a chef. You don't have a sous chef. You don't have a person who's doing the dishwashing. You don't get deliveries of crates of food every day. You can't do it. So we need to, like, set our expectations. And in some ways, that's why, you know, seemingly nutty ideas like Cheetos on peanut butter, which I'm never gonna get that image out of my head.
You're gonna try it later.
It's okay. We won't judge you.
Or leftover tikka masala on baked potato. You know, it's like, fine, you're hungry, you need to eat something. I remember doing a story 30, 40 years ago, not unlike what we're doing now, where I called older food writers.
Yeah. We're coming up on a break.
Them now
we got
dead.
To get to a break, yeah.
Okay.
All right, we'll finish that story on the other side mm-hmm. of this break. Thanks so much. That's Mark Bittman. And we're talking with Margaret Eby as well about cooking when you don't want to cook, simplifying cooking. And we have a lot of suggestions from you. Keep them coming. Studio2@whyy.org. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. All right.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We are talking about ways this hour to simplify cooking for those times when you're exhausted and burnt out. We're getting some ideas and shortcuts from two great guests, Philadelphia Inquirer Deputy Food Editor Margaret Eby, who has a new cookbook called You Gotta Eat, and Mark Bittman, author of the beloved How to Cook Everything cookbooks. He has a new one called How to Cook Everything Kids.
And we want to hear your go-to meals when you really don't feel like cooking. What do you make? Share your cooking hacks, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. I want to read a couple of these emails. Diane says, cheese and crackers and sliced apples with other available charcuterie type goodies, grilled cheese and ham sandwiches with sliced fruit. I can get with that, Diane.
Oh, for sure.
Erica writes, ravioli, store-bought with greens, steamed broccoli rabe or sautéed spinach. Also, tuna fish salad with a green salad. That's reasonable. A nice quick go-to.
Reasonable. Yeah. And Mark, I wanted to get back to your story that you were talking about. You had done an exercise like this. It sounded like a few decades ago. Could you finish that anecdote?
Well, it's the same. It's actually, Cherry just finished it. I remember calling this guy who I just adored, and he had done a really sophisticated, complex books about fish in different parts of the world, Mediterranean, Southeast Asia, North Atlantic, etc. And I called him and I said, so what do you do on nights when you don't feel like cooking? He's like, we have tuna fish sandwiches and glass of milk. And it's like, okay, that's, you know, we get that. I don't know, maybe the challenge is more, what do you do on nights when you do feel like cooking? Because the non-cooking stuff, everybody's got their go-to. People don't starve, or people with money don't starve. Yeah. So, you know, we all have solutions.
Here's a solution from, which one do I want to read? They're so good.
So many, I know.
Okay. This is Bashir, who says, beef sausages and vegetarian beans, odd combo, add heavy butter and cinnamon.
That's cinnamon.
I get it, but I don't get it.
I'm trying to, like, imagine the cinnamon. But I guess cinnamon with some beef.
That makes sense. That makes sense to me. I want to ask you, Margaret, because, look, part of this, the inspiration for your book comes from dealing with depression. Right. We're talking about a couple years ago. Talk about how that experience informed the book.
Yeah. So I am a pretty enthusiastic home cook. I'm the kind of lunatic who will make a croquembouche for fun. I have multiple kinds of salts. People come over to my house for butter tastings. You know, I am that person in the friend group. But a couple of years ago, I found myself having no interest or energy for cooking. I was having a really bad depressive episode, and I just could not muster any energy to feed myself. And I'm a person who has unusual access and resources for cooking, right? Like, I know a lot of chefs. It's my literal job. I've been to culinary school. I have all this knowledge, but it didn't matter because I couldn't access any kind of energetic stores to do the actual cooking. And so a lot of this book is basically for people who want to cook, but, like, there's that step missing between wanting to and, like, being able to, like, have the strength to, like, pull out a pan and, like, clean the pan and have to figure out the bowl situation. Because I figure if that happens to me, it has to be happening to a lot of other people. Whether it's depression or, you know, you are going through a really busy time, or you have a new kid, or you have a new puppy, or you're taking care of an elderly parent, or whatever it is, there's a lot of times in life when, even if the will is there, the way is not always there.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is you organize the book by the level of energy one has to affect, you know, a meal. And can you tell me, like, because you go from just going to the pantry, picking up a couple of things, some beans or whatever, to actually having a full casserole.
Mm-hmm. For me, when I'm going through something, I have, like, certain mental blocks in the kitchen. I'm like, all right, here's what I can deal with today. Yeah. I can definitely deal with a microwave. I can deal with a blender, but I can under no circumstances turn on the stove. And or I'll be like, you know, I can feed myself some cheese and crackers. Maybe I can deal with a knife. I can cut up an apple. But like there are some things that are just totally beyond me. Because, you know, traditional recipes, which I am a huge fan of. I'm a recipe developer and like a real like person who pours over cookbooks for fun. Often I think the energy output to get to that meal aren't included because it's like, well, okay, yes, like we have the ingredients, but like and you know, part of it is like recipe developers have no idea what your kitchen is like, and they have no idea that your sheet pan is under like 15 cookbooks in order to extricate it. You know, it would require three people.
Need like, a forklift, yeah.
Yeah, like how would they know that? So I wanted to make things as accessible and easy as possible for like, okay, like what do you have in you today? Like what resources do you have, not just in terms of like what's in your pantry and what equipment do you have, but like what emotional resources
do you have? There's actually it comes up throughout the book. There's a way that you allow someone to roll a die four times and create either a bean salad or a smoothie. And if you read the book, you'll understand it better. But even decision fatigue sometimes comes into play when it comes to cooking. I want to ask you, Mark, about writing How to Cook Everything, How to Cook Everything Kids, and if that changed your perspective on food at all, writing for that audience and having to translate the concepts for that audience.
It's a good question, and it did. Look, I think the overall goal of cookbooks is to somehow encourage people to get into the kitchen and do stuff. Really, in a way, the goal of cookbooks should be to make cookbooks obsolete for the people who are using them. Mm-hmm. That is, you use them, you learn how to do it, you don't have to think about it anymore. It becomes fun and automatic, and some days you don't feel like doing it, and that's fine too. So the thing about the kids' book was, how do you get kids into the kitchen and interested? And it's not by saying, okay, you're going to go do this stuff in the kitchen. It's by saying, let's go in the kitchen. Let's explore. What would you like to make? What can we make? What's realistic to make? We're going to do it together. It's not like you throw your 8-year-old in the kitchen and say, make me some lasagna. You know, what does the spice drawer look like? What does the pots and pans drawer look like? What's in the refrigerator? What can we do? What's possible? What would you like? And of course, because they're kids, they're going to say chocolate chip cookies or marshmallows or whatever. You know, they're going to say something sweet. And that's, you know, that's fine also. This is not, there's this way in which a lot of what I do is not preachy so much, but there's values attached to it. And I think with kids, in a way, you have to kind of drop that and say the value is, let's try to understand food. Let's get to know food a little bit. Let's play around with food, and we'll take it from there. It's not, let's eat less sugar. Let's eat less junk. But it is, there are real ingredients. There is real food. Let's try to get familiar with that. And that's in a way a different from what my other books have been like.
Yeah. I want to bring in another caller. And thanks for that, Mark. I love that. I want to bring in Marty from Elkins Park, who's on the line. Marty, what's your go-to meal?
Well, it's anything and everything. I mean, the first thing is, I guess the principles you spoke of earlier, of people coming home from work and, oh my gosh, the chore and the burden. I look at the kitchen as a place and a way to transition to being home and to relaxing and unwinding, and just leave me alone in the kitchen and I'll turn on NPR or some music and just get into almost meditative. Or if I want to release my anger with the knife, I'll just chop away at those vegetables. So first of all, I think of a few principles in the kitchen, you know, freedom, bravery, creativity. Just go for it and have fun and enjoy the time. I've been a vegetarian 52 years, so it's really hard to go out to a lot of restaurants and feel sufficiently satisfied, but nothing satisfies me like my meals. And it's often, I heard a mantra, you know, a great chef has to have great ingredients. What's that all about? My feeling is a great chef will make a great meal out of whatever's in the refrigerator, you know, almost spoiling, mixing it all up, yesterday's leftovers mixed with something else, and just the freedom of being able to just put stuff together and let it go.
I love that. That's kitchen therapy with Marty from Elkins Park.
I love that,
and here's Amy from Elkins Park. Shout out to Elkins Park, by the way. Amy says, when we get to Thursdays and we don't feel like just leftovers, we often throw what we have in the fridge into a frittata or on a pizza dough.
I like that.
Which, by the way, is in the book. The frittata thing is an amazing hack. Let's bring in another caller now because we just have a lot of folks who have been waiting. Diana from Audubon, Pennsylvania on line 7. Diana, you're on Studio 2. What's your go-to easy meal?
Okay, great. First off, can I just say I love you guys and I love this show.
Oh, thank
you. It's one of my favorite shows.
Thank you.
Okay, so, yeah, I love the chemistry. And this is a great topic. I love to cook. I also feel just like your guest. I'm in a phase where I don't want to cook. But listening to you all right now makes me think of my uncle, Stephen, who he has this thing where, okay, so it's his version of a sloppy Joe. Mm-hmm. And he's a very picky eater. And he's very funny and he's adorable. So he basically came up with this thing and it's a mess what he does. So you guys talked about potatoes. He would get some potatoes, super simple, throw them in the oven or even boil them really quickly, right? Ground beef, you can have that doing its thing on the side. That's also simple, fast, drain the beef. Take the potatoes, put it in like a Pyrex dish, line the bottom of the pan, get some ground beef, throw salsa, whatever salsa you want on top of it.
Salsa.
Get your grated ground, like your cheese or whatever, put the cheese on top, pop it in the oven for like, I don't know, 5 minutes just to let it melt and come together and congeal or whatever. And then he calls it a disheveled Jose.
Oh, yes.
Thank you so much, Diana.
Diana.
Thank you so much. Maybe should we share ours, Cherry?
We should share.
Our go-to?
Definitely.
Yeah, I'll let you go first, Avi. Go right ahead.
Mine is not that out there, but when I just really feel like I have to make something any hour of the day, I always go first into my fridge for leftover rice. I love reheated leftover rice, especially if you crisp it up a little bit in the pan. And then usually the main thing I'll do is fried eggs on top, scallions, hot sauce. To me, that's a meal. Maybe I need a couple eggs there to make it a whole meal. But for me, that is a meal I could eat anytime.
Yeah, I'm a big egg person. And somebody, Linda from Doylestown, says she's surprised no one has brought up eggs. She says if you have a carton of eggs in the fridge, you have a meal. And I am a eggs and salsa person. I always keep bags of frozen flatbread in the freezer. So I will scramble a whole bunch of eggs, put cheese, and I'll put like a whole jar, like a jar of salsa in there.
A whole jar?
Well, like half. Because it was a
lot
of
No judgment.
People.
I'm just asking. Yeah, you mean that literally.
I like this black bean. I have like three different types of salsa, by the way. So it depends on what kind of mood I'm in. Black bean salsa, tomato sauce, all the different salsas. But I mix it all up. I have it with flatbread. If I may have sausages or not, but you can eat it during the day or not. You can add chicken to that. Leftover chicken, chop that up in the eggs. It's really good.
Salsa is the star of the show. The
salsa, everybody brought salsa up
of the show.
And it goes with everything.
It's a sleeper hit. Also, I love that you have multiple kinds because that's what I'm talking about.
That's huge. That's huge.
See, I'm taking, yes. And by the way, my Trader Joe's has like a whole salsa section.
Absolutely.
Which is where
I mean,
my
condiments
from.
Are, you know, there's a reason ketchup was the country's most popular vegetable for 50 years.
Absolutely.
Condiments change everything.
And Mark, I don't know, is famous the right word, but you have this stir-fried chicken recipe with ketchup. That's one of my go-tos as a simple, you know, meal. I don't eat chicken anymore, but when I did.
It's really good with cauliflower.
Ooh, there you go. So I can make the same thing with cauliflower.
Yeah, absolutely, same thing. Everything is the same.
Look up this recipe. By stir-fried chicken with ketchup, and you can do stir-fried, apparently, cauliflower with ketchup. But you don't think about how versatile and ketchup really is as a flavor enhancer, until you see it used in different ways, not just on a hot dog. And I think that's really eye-opening.
Ketchup and mustard mixed together on top of meatloaf. Oh, that's the meatloaf sauce right there.
There you go.
You put ketchup and you mix it up, and you could throw some barbecue sauce in there too. Just
yes. Yes.
Before we go, I do, though, have to ask Margaret real quickly about savory oatmeal, mm-hmm. because this is the next frontier for me, is savory oatmeal.
That's next level.
You're a fan, right?
Oh, I love a savory oatmeal, 100%, because it's just a bowl of oats. Like, no reason it needs to be sweet.
Exactly.
No reason.
Exactly.
You get your good friend egg, also my good friend, and then you put it on there. Chili crisp. I had that this morning, actually. Mm. Like fried egg, chili crisp.
On oatmeal.
So good.
Could even boil the oatmeal in something savory, right? Like,
for sure.
It doesn't have to be water. It could be in a broth or whatever. And I do think that that's what I'm talking about, where, like, oatmeal is just a grain base. There's no reason it has to be breakfast. It's just our cultural tradition that makes it a quote-unquote breakfast thing. And once you start breaking down those artificial barriers, I do think your pantry opens up to you in a lot of ways. And that's what this conversation has done for me, what this book mm-hmm. and all of Mark's work over the years has helped me do. And I thank both of you so much for being here today.
Yes.
Ending with my little treatise, apparently. Margaret Ebi, author of You Gotta Eat, and deputy food editor at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was so fun.
And yeah. Mark Bittman, former New York Times food columnist, author of How to Cook Everything and the new cookbook, How to Cook Everything, Kids. Thank you so much for joining us, Mark.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Should we read a couple more?
I was going to read a couple more. We have Frank, who says, gotta love couscous. Gives a whole way of preparing that couscous. Says you can have the veggies, tofu prepped to go in the fridge. Debbie cooks a lot of food, but then she freezes it and will pull out a jar of casserole or dishes she has frozen later on to eat. So thank you to all our callers. Thank you to everybody who emailed in. We appreciate you. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Besser, Andreas Copes, Al Banks, and Tina Calique. Engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk with you tomorrow.